Hello and welcome. Thanks for coming back from Coffee and Tea for a wonderful presentation today. This is the Collective Activist and Archives in Motion. My name is AC Pinella, but I just go by Pinella, like Madonna or Rihanna. It's just one name. And today we have a wonderful group of fantastic panelists. I'll introduce each one as they come up. They have about 20 minutes to present, and then we'll save questions for the end if that works well. Our first speaker today is Tonchi. Tonchi works as a coordinator and curator and researcher at the Queer and Archive in Split Croatia, and he'll talk a little bit more about what he's been working on.
Okay. Hello. Oops,
hello.
Not this way. So now I'm getting back to what I wanted to say. I'm going to present an art research today. It's called Invisible Traces of History. And the idea behind this was to create an alternative historical narrative through creation of an archive. But before that, I want to say a few words about the organization. So basically, with some friends, we founded this Queer and Archive group in 2010. And since 2013, we work as a formal organization, basically registered for the funds and so we can apply for the projects. And this artistic researches that we do sometimes are just one part of the whole program. The program consists of different workshops, exhibitions, and a small festival. I also find it very important to explain better the whole context of this research, how it happened, and more from the economical point of view and the project point of view. So it is not like an academic research, and no one involved in this was working at that time, or in institutions, or anywhere, basically. And we had a small grant from different sites, from different donors from Croatia. It was like a total of around maybe 5,000 euros, from which we had to do the research part, the production part, and two exhibitions. And so I can now start with the motivation part, like how the whole idea came. Certain kind of loss was detected because the whole research is basically about memory of all older gay men and their experience of the sexual practices in town of Split. And somewhere from Zagreb. So this was at the beginning, it was not like defined what this sense of loss, but kind of a change in the whole way that people behave and practice, like their sexual life was detected, and we wanted to go to talk to people and see how it worked. Before we then determined with the research as a period after decriminalization of homosexuality in Yugoslavia, which happened in 1977, and before the war when the Yugoslavia break apart, but also this war is connected to the development of LGBTIQ activism. So this is like the starting point from with the research material, although we didn't keep it very chronologically, but it is from this period between the decriminalization and the war and start of a normalization of LGBTIQ communities through activist advocacy actions. And I'm going to, oh, I'm not changing this one, I'm changing this one. So I'm so sorry. but there were no photos, so you didn't miss anything. So we started to, because I can't get the notes in this one, so I'm reading the notes from this one and getting the image from this one. We started with collecting oral histories and, oops, different direction. So we talked to people about their experience of how they met other people, how they formed the communities, how they communicated between themselves at that time. And like this was probably the hardest part because although this period was, when they described it, it was a kind of, well, you get impression of a lot of freedoms and not that much social pressure. But on the other hand, it all happened in some very closed, like niche spaces. So it was kind of don't ask, don't tell situation where they felt like very free to do whatever they want when they are at certain spaces, groups, but like it was not communicated to the rest of society. Although all these places were like very central in town and basically they were visible all the time. So from this oral history, that is one part of the research, we did a film that I will show you just a minute of it now, and I can share the link if someone wants to see it all. But like the film is in Croatian, so you will not get the story, but the quotes are like the one from before, and is it going? And the images are from the spaces that are related to this story. So basically this is kind of creating like remembering the memory of the space that is not visible in the space itself, but it needs like the narrator who tells the story.
Ujutro se išlo u WC na željezničkoj stanici, onaj prvi, fino je zaklonjen i moga si unaprijed vidjeti ako neko dolazi.
So that's just to get the idea how it looks like. And so this, talking to these people and this policy of don't ask, don't tell, they refer to it as a discretion, and it is still very present, and we recognize this discretion as a result of the social oppression of the being different and having a different sexual habits. And so like the voice in the film is not like the original voice of the person who was telling the story, because most of them didn't even let us record them. Although we explained that it's not going to be public, but they, to feel comfortable even to tell us, they didn't want to have a recorder. So it's like still present, this discretion that comes from oppression very much in the society today in Split. And our research went further in also develop thinking about what archives are and what how they function and what they would be. And then we did like recognize this repetition, reproduction, and reinterpretation that comes from the Derrida's book of Archive Fever. And he calls on Freud theory of memory that is based on these three principles, let's call them. And so our artistic approach to the subject used this repetition, reproduction, interpretation in creating documents, visual documents that could represent the oral history we collected. So, oops, I'm again on the wrong computer. and wrong direction. apart from, I mean, from the stories of the oral history, we heard about personal ads that were present in the, these were mostly like sex and erotic pornographic magazines that also at that time had political articles, because they were kind of a space that was not mainstream, so like the different political opinions could be expressed in a magazine, like a pornographic magazine, that wouldn't ever be published in a mainstream magazine. So it was kind of a strange mix of press. And so we did find some of all the magazines with the ads that you can see in the screen. And so our approach was to visualize this. We had, on the one hand, the oral history, but where people told us how it functioned. And then we opened the call for young artists, activists, and whoever wants to join, to respond to the ads in the way that people would respond before. Basically, they told us that they were sending photos of themselves, but they were not like today, if you meet someone for sex or something, it's mostly nudes and sex photos, but they had to go to the copy store to copy photo, they were usually like something from family album, and then they would copy it. So we did the same process, but we repeated it with young artists and activists who responded to these photos with their family photos, and then we copied them and then scanned them, and then at the exhibition they were basically these materials printed. And that's at the same time like the research of the possibilities of an image to represent a document to become like authentic material. And so this like a bad image kind of invites you to think of it, why is it bad image and what stands behind, what could be the whole story. That's the one of the ways we try to represent it. So this is one more. Then there was the other kind of workshop based on the oral history that was trying to recreate the way people were meeting at the gay beaches. So at this time that we are talking about, the gay beach was basically in the center of the town on the main, whatever it's called, like when you have the thing where the ship stops, so on the other side.
Harbor?
Dock, like, or, yes. And nowadays, the cruising ships are stopping there, so it's not in use, but then we also invited, like, this group of young artists and activists to go for one day to the new gay beach, which visually looks very similar as the old one was, and to spend day with cameras and photos and to develop material that would be kind of based on the stories and reinterpret these stories. So this image like this one came out, and this is this one wanted to present this discretion principle again, which was like very very strong, because we even talked to some people that they're still coming to the beach, and we asked them for their experience from the previous time, and we know that they were on the beaches before because the other told us, but they would tell us that they have never been there, that they don't know everything about this. So this is like this strong element of self-censorship, and that's the way how we presented it in the documents that were part of the exhibition, I mean artworks. And so this is the same thing. And also like the other way was like just framing it that you don't see the faces, which was like also very important thing, or this extremely blown up image that you can't recognize anything, but it also at the same time transfers some of the atmosphere and the way it's was happening. And this was the other person doing with some of those instant cameras working on analog film, and then from this it makes a lot of mistakes and in the filming, and then we created a video, short one, of these images. And so basically this is the end of my presentation. I hope I'm in time. And this is also one quote from, as this research was parallelly the art research, working in the production of artworks, but also on the theory of archives and archival art. And this is from Hal Foster, from his text about, it's called Archive Fever, I think. And this is actually from the footnotes, but this was like sounded like very good quote for this one, mm-hmm. and to think about archives as well. So maybe this also is something to think now when we're thinking about memory, queering memory and archiving, that there must be something kind of a disaster to stand behind it. And it's also related to the Derrida's work and Freud, because they found this dead drive connected to archival drive. And yes, that's all for me for today. You can have an opportunity to ask questions.
So our next two presenters, being set up, this is Jazz and TL. They're both from the University of Toronto, but different departments. And they're going to be talking to you a little bit more about the active social life of queer archives and issues of metadata. And I'll use this time to also remind you that there's a play tonight that you're welcome to come to after we have a little break at the end of this show. So.
Oh, thank you. It's so thrilling to be presenting with you all, and I was like, I wanted to do all of the snaps and hand whistles and everything with everything that you were all saying. So we have a ridiculous title, The Active Social Life of Queer Archives, Making Metadata for Memories, or Against Metadata for Memories, Intimating Intramedial Intimacies, Processing Paradox, Performance, and Promiscuity, and Collecting Collective Contextual Consent. So you can kind of play bingo with all of these words, and some of them we hit on and some of them we don't in the context of this particular presentation. But anyhow, this is what we came up with. okay, so I'm going to begin by doing just kind of situating us. We're both settlers, white settlers in the land that is now called Canada, also called Turtle Island. We both work at the University of Toronto, which is located on the territory of the Huron-Wendat, the Petun First Nations, the Seneca, and the Mississaugas of the Credit River. We arrive here in Berlin after having spent time at an encuentro in Mexico City and a week in Madrid and Barcelona. Traveling from Toronto to Mexico City, Madrid, and Barcelona, now to Berlin, we're intensely conscious of the privilege of doing this kind of travel and of the ongoing colonial violences that continue to shape Toronto and Mexico City and Madrid and Barcelona. Coming to Berlin, we reflect on the ways that research is a way that has long legitimated fascism, racism, and genocide across centuries and continents. So this is the kind of context of what we do. The main research questions that continue to motivate our work are, what if the ethical and evaluative structures of academic research did not normalize systems of exploitation? And how do we shift our praxis when we realize that our research is doing harm, even when we think we're repairing harm?
Here, we're considering the tactics and temporalities of community-based collecting, remediation, and exhibition practices that reflect trans, feminist, and queer socialities, performances, and memories. Apologies for this voice, all that travel. Our digital project is called the Cabaret Commons, which is linked closely to our Digital Research Ethics Collaboratory, or DREC. Cabaret Commons is our most recent in a long stream of experiments towards building an online archive of TFQ cabaret performance materials. That is, materials related to the lo-fi, transnational, and persistent genre of the cabaret, a short act, political theatrics, VR variety show, fundraiser, party, creative lab. As a quick clarifying note, by trans, feminist, and queer, or TFQ scenes, we're referring to those driven by and oriented centrally towards an always shifting intersectional trans, feminist, queer aesthetic, politic, and ethics that rejects the political, economic, and aesthetic supremacy of pride capitalism, or the TFQ scenes that we're talking about are the ones with an analysis of power and without money. Our digital experiments revolve around several questions. How do we account for and cultivate the active social lives of the materials that make up TFQ artistic and activist collections? Operating with the awareness that the vast majority of TFQ artistic and activist materials are produced in a social context, collaboratively, or with particular audiences in mind, how do we practice the time-heavy work of collective consent and community collaboration in the design and development of online archives that can both represent and continue this sociality? how do we work against the erasure of TFQ histories and sociologies while not reproducing extractive, non-reciprocal research, publication, and exhibition practices, especially in the era of digital archives and repositories. Following the very innovative and field-shifting work of Indigenous and non-Indigenous collaborators building the Mukutu content management system, it's called Mukutu if you want to look it up, how do we build protocols that prioritize what Kim Kristen has called the sociality of information rather than the freedom of information?
So we'll leave these questions up for a minute. So after almost a decade of consultation and research, we have found that while most TFQ artists, activists, organizers, and audiences that we work with do not tend to want all of their archival materials to be openly accessible and searchable online, they, and we, do want some kind of online social space for these materials to share with others who are already part of those worlds and to share with TFQ worlds beyond. Based on our research, we have found that some TFQ artists and activists want their materials to be shared on the World Wide Web, but they want that set of materials to be heavily curated and with takedown policies that operate both at the speed of light and retroactively. That is, when and if homophobic, transphobic, or misogynist attention comes to their materials online, they wish not only to take it down, but for it to never have been there in the first place. So while this is basically technically impossible, based on the infinite refraction and so screenshotting, et cetera, infinite refraction of material posted online, Google scraping, large-scale sharing, et cetera, we aim for a very small data experiment in what an ideal digital design might look like for TFQ artists, activists, audiences, researchers, and archivists. All right, so this is just a background. So we've been working on this since 2011, and it was just about 6 or 8 months ago that we have our first public site. So this is just a database shot of our first proof of concept. This is the first time we started adding metadata to images and other pieces of materials from cabarets, specifically of the Meow Mix Cabaret in Montreal. As soon as we started entering metadata, we were like, fuck, we have to stop this, because all of a sudden people's names will be able to be found. People's dead names, so you'd be detonating people's dead names, especially in the context of transness, and people who don't want their faces to be recognized and associated with those names, all of those kinds of things. So this was a space where we decided against metadata. This is just another beta site that we had on the Canadian Writing Research Collaboratory. This is what the Cabaret Commons on WordPress looked like for about 7 years. And these are some of the behind-the-scenes things that happened, where we were experimenting with a lot of visual description, a lot of accessibility stuff, and then also a lot of scene and context information for every single piece. But every time we started to do that, every time we started to add data to the materials, we realized that they would become more and more vulnerable. The more data you add, the more vulnerable they would become. And so, for example, we had pages and pages and pages of an email listserv that happened for about 12 years. And we thought, well, that's, you know, something that could be shared, and it's a beautiful, beautiful archive. And then we just realized that there was so much personal information embedded in the listserv. People asking for someone to look after their cat, someone asking for, you know, saying that they're unemployed and needed work. All of those things were part of that listserv that we decided ultimately not to share. But it was only in the act of onlining that we figured out that that material wasn't safe to share without the consent of everyone involved.
So what we realized is that the Cabaret Commons needs to be modeled on the protocols and technologies of what we've been calling TFQ Networked Intimate Publics, or NIPS. So that's TFQ NIPS, which I think is clever. NIPS cultivate protocols and technologies to avoid unwanted exposure, over-circulation, and unintended scales of growth and publicity, while also creating what Shaka McLaughlin has been calling, or has called, virtual intimacies, which may augment and, as he puts it, transform the intimacies we already have and condition the possibilities for as yet unknown forms of intimacy to be cultivated. NIPS have always operated offline, but the challenge is how to recognize and support their thriving online. The Cabaret Commons is a project that we've been working on with many collaborators since around 2011. At first, we thought it was going to be all about onlining, that is, moving from offline to online, the analog or not widely distributed archives and repertoires of photos, posters, videos, stories, and other ephemera and documentation from transfeminists and TFQ cabarets, live variety shows. From across the hemispheric Americas was what we were thinking about, in order to build translocal knowledge, facilitate exchange between artists, showcase the amazing political, sexual, social work being done and TFQ on the TFQ cabaret stages across these spaces, and to provide a research site for scholars of TFQ histories, politics, and expressive cultures. But when we started to online these materials, we realized there's something deeply disturbing about moving these materials, which had almost always been intended for small, friend-based, intimate, local audiences, usually of no more than 100 people, to the potentially infinite and potentially expressly unfriendly, phobic and possibly dangerous or toxic and trolling on the audiences of the internet. So we started working with various collaborators to design a consent and artist-centered digital project which would prioritize a theoretical and practical harm reduction and careful application of TFQ intimacies offline and online. Rather than building an archive of everything we could get our hands on, we decided to build the Cabaret Commons Critical Practice and the Cabaret Commons Exhibition Place, with the hope that highly curated publication and exhibition spaces would create some remediation filter between the small world, small-scale live performance, and the infinite world, infinite scale of the internet. We decided to design for the internet, to make new materials designed for internet audiences rather than try to move TFQ Cabaret intact online. The Cabaret Commons is a site of creation-based research to theorize this practice as we do it, and our first set of publications are the Cabaret Commons Keywords, Cabaret Commons Critical Practice, and some process posts written by longtime collaborators Islandia Guzman and Itziana Gutierrez. While we've been working on very speculative, pragmatic, participatory, creation-based design experiments, and now many proof of concepts, we've really been heavily theorizing what we affectionately call a lesbian method of heavy press processing or microprocessing, various aspects of what remediation, transmediation, transplatformization mean for small world TFQ scenes.
So what is TFQ Cabaret? Just out of curiosity, how many people think in this room think that they have at one time been at or performed in a cabaret, a transfeminist queer cabaret? Okay. Well, I believe most of you have been. So what do we mean by TFQ Cabaret? We consider cabaret one of the great, vital, and sustaining forms of translocal TFQ expressive social, political, and sexual culture. And by cabaret, following from the work on cabaret that I've been doing for a long time as a solo scholar, as well as our and our collaborators' collective understandings, we mean the small-scale, grassroots, very local, satirical variety show, which vary in form from locale to locale and are slightly different between, for example, Montreal, New York City, Mexico City, and Berlin. TFQ cabaret tends to occur in small and cheap spaces, tends to feature sets of short performances of 5 to 15 minutes. That's what I want. So this is from the Miamix cabaret. Across genre and form, so drag, dance, spoken word, music, installation, visual art, sound art, stand-up, sketch or improv, comedy, video art, film, and much more. And all these forms explicitly work against other forms of supremacy in our contemporary culture, whether it's against many forms of racism and misogynoir, hearkening Moya Bailey, transphobia and transmisogyny, against sexism, fatphobia, lesbophobia, against ongoing settler and neocolonial violence, extractive capitalism, discrimination through other lived experiences of poverty, migration and immigration, disability and mental illness. Significantly, while this laundry list of oppressive realities is certainly what TFQ performance is often about or in response to, it's as much about creating and reveling in joy as it is about pain. That is, TFQ cabaret performance is as much about love as it is about loss, as much about fashioning meaningful spaces in which we can take risks with each other, as it is about fabulous fashion, as it is about the danger of being exposed to an unfriendly world. It is much about a party as it is about a performance, as much about hooking up as it is about making hilariously devastating work about breaking up, as much about sharing our stories with each other as it is about making new stories together. It is almost most centrally about intimacy and the ways that performers and audiences create intimacy and at least a provisional kind of trust in whatever configuration they find themselves. But the element that really makes or breaks a show is the audience and its capacity to fabulate along with the performers, to do the work of creating a space of intimacy, togetherness, risk, shared pain and joy, vulnerability and exuberance. If an audience does not understand and appreciate the codes of the show, doesn't help to produce an enthusiastically raucous cabaret dynamic, if the audience is unfamiliar with the style of the show, if the audience cannot be trusted with the performers or kinds of performances, with the space of the performance, with the aesthetics, ethics, politics, and erotics of the show, if the audience refuses to pick up what the show is putting down or to respect the risks the performers and many of the spectators are taking to be there, then the show not only flops, it becomes a potential site of harm.
Small cabarets are networks of mutual risk, care, and collectively calibrated scale. Each performer brings 5 to 10 friends and friends of friends. If there's 10 artists, you can expect 50 to 100 people to attend the show, plus whoever comes because they know the work of one of our performers, a fan of the cabaret series, a regular at the bar, a crush on somebody's friend. While each performer brings an integral audience or an intended insider supportive audience, or those in the know, there may be an odd, occasional, accidental audience situation from time to time, but importantly, this is within the reception context of mixed and overlapping integral or intended audiences, and the reception context is embodied, influenced by the ethics, affects, and behaviors of the majority integral intended audience. These negotiated intimacies create and depend upon a set of often unstated ethical attachments to the valuing of and caring for risky behaviors, for behaviors that make us vulnerable. These are places in which risk is expected, desired, and desirable. And ideally, you could trust that scene, or at least a few intimates within that scene, that would care for you through any consequence of those risks. For a couple of researchers to come around and post it all up online requires some protocol that both accounts for the ethics of risk within these scenes and gives participants the option to refuse to extend that risk or the documentation of those risks to the very different, often punitive scenes of the internet. So TFQ scenes thrive on networked intimate publics. These are dynamic, agential, hybrid formations that blur an individual and collective, an inside and outside, and use a network structure or something like it to shape aesthetic, political, social thought and participation. The individuals involved both engage with and are sheltered from the public, and it's assembled via an individualized network that forms a public face. These NIPs often innovate their own hybrid analog-digital methods for distributing the risk of publicity or exposure. They have good reason for maintaining a cautious distance from fully public online existence, since feminists, queers, transgender people, especially those who are negatively racialized, low-income, disabled, migrant, immigrant, HIV-positive, and otherwise precariously situated are, of course, disproportionately targeted for online and in-person harassment and violence. So how do we contend with the fact that the imagined audience for most TFQ performances are those in the know, whereas an online audience necessarily includes non-insider audiences, those not in the know? Importantly, TFQ performances often not only produce for its predisposed and supportive audience, but also those within a performance scene conditioned by the assumed or assured absence of hostile or even indifferent audiences. That is, it's not only about those who are in the room, but also those who are really importantly not in the room or not allowed in the room, that allows the kind of work that happens on TFQ stages to happen.
And so just to finish up, one of the frameworks we're working with that is that of X infinity reception, something that I've been playing around with as a way to think ethically and methodologically about designing for the online condition of endless possibilities which need to be anticipated and accounted for both, and which is impossible, for both in the process of platform design and development and in the responsible maintenance once the platform goes live, so in constant updates and keeping up to date with the kinds of scraping and other things that are happening. Riffing on Beth Coleman's theory of X-reality, that is, our hybrid and simultaneously real and virtual existences. So what we're thinking about specifically is having active takedown policies, ongoing consent protocols, process posts, and highlighting practices of refusal. And here's a post that was just published last week on practices of refusal on the Digital Research Ethics Collaboratory, and other marginalized methods for staying safe. And here is Alex Tiglar's three-part piece on sex worker visibility online and offline. In our collective efforts, we're attempting to draw ethical attention to the infinite variables of reception and circulation, thinking about online reception as the active social lives of archives, opened up or differently potentially and massively activated by bringing performance materials and other minoritized materials online, and how, as researchers, archivists, publishers, and so on, we can attend to the expansive desires, pleasures, risks, and pains of opening ourselves and our collections up to audiences and algorithms well beyond the worlds we've worked hard to build. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much for bearing with our tech situation.
Thank you. Please give a round of applause to all of our presenters today. Or so for questions for all of our presenters. Yeah, friends.
Just for the last two, what about for the really long-term storage and sharing of that information, like once all the breeding results have died, what kind of provisions in your platform do you have for that kind of long-term sharing?
Well, one of the ways that kind of material gets talked about is as orphaned material.
Yeah.
And this is something that this is one of the reasons we're working at such a small scale, is that we're working on that at a case-by-case basis. So one of the things we're trying to do is not work on a template basis, even though we are using WordPress, but building a new site every time there's a new exhibition. And for each curator of an exhibition and each author of a post, to determine how they're going to deal with those situations. So in some communities, it makes sense to like blur faces of people who are no longer here, or people who want the picture up but they don't want to be identified. And so this idea that there's a one-size-fits-all ethical solution for how to online these materials is something that we're trying to move away from. But my personal perspective is that just because someone's gone or you can't find them doesn't mean that they've given consent for the material to be up there. But I realize that that's like a kind of conservative or like kind of paranoid, but I feel it that it's this thing that's going on constantly in terms of digital archives. It's people who just are like, put it all up, and then just if someone asks to take it down, then take it down. And we're like, let's ask first. Let's try that. Yeah.
Other folks?
Everybody, and I'm gonna like kind of verbally process this for a second since the question will form hopefully quickly. But I've worked with oral histories, and I've been working with oral histories for about 7 years now, and so have with a collective, and so have over 50 oral histories at this point that are kind of living, and we're struggling with wanting these to be widely accessible, like knowing that we don't own the story. the people who told us still own the story. We have them somehow, but people reach out to us and want them. But if we give them to just anybody, we don't know how they'll use them. And this kind of like tension has stopped us from making a digital interface. And I feel like all of you all are dealing with this kind of instability in the archive that makes it hard for the like general public to access. And I'm curious if there's how you deal with that kind of attention of like both wanting the stories out there and also wanting to in some way like protecting anonymity and also other things.
Who will start?
You.
Okay, this is like a good question, but when we started collecting oral history, it was never idea to use it as stories that are presented as a personal stories of with the name and the face, or in that way connected to a person. It was more idea to connect it to the spaces and to connect it to the documents that are only not very directly even connected to it. Basically, like the photo in the swimming trunks came in the selection for the material representation, because there is a story that like is it's not like presented the story, but there was a story that one person remembered that he fell in love with another person wearing like blue swimming trunks, and then that story was transferred to the participants of the workshop, and then it was selected as a material that kind of presents the whole situation. And yes, so it is based on something very personal, but then also kind of very depersonalized, because at the end it's not related in any way to this person. And I don't know if it's like a good approach or not, but it's like it works here, because all of the people that were giving the stories, they have seen the materials, and they, I mean, even without explanation that this like part reflects to the story, they would make connection, and they thought it was funny or good thing, or they didn't feel like threatened or exposed with this way. But this is, I mean, I also have to say that this was like a very small group of people, and there was kind of a trust built there, and we never insisted on anything that people didn't want to share, so we didn't have, I mean, it was kind of a semi-structural talk, but it was more the person who was giving the story that was leading it where it will go and telling what they wanted to say. So it was kind of a community. I mean, I can't say that this is a community that produced this, because those all people together are not a part of one community, but somehow it was on a very small scale, and it was easy to communicate with everyone what's going to happen with they do. Because there was another project before ours, also collecting oral histories, but it was more like, I mean, it was not like a mainstream research, it was like a queer NGO doing it, but they just wanted like the oral history connected to different towns and different age groups, and present it as a text that comes only from the from people which were not like names there, but they were like presented as a like 56-year-old person from Split, and then told his story. And they were also very considerate to the people's reasons why they would or would not. So people gave them the stories, and then they told them that they will ask them at the end when the book is prepared if they are still okay. And a lot of people didn't want to have the story at the end, because they felt like it's too much for them. So, but I think we managed to avoid this problem doing an art project, which is at the end something completely different. That's my personal point of view on this question.
Do our other presenters have responses to the question?
I guess we're not there yet. We don't really have an accessible archive, but this has been very interesting food for thought for when eventually we're going to get there, both the presentation and your question. And in a way, our answers will be similar to the one that Tonsi already gave, but we also found a community-based organization, and the people were evicted from the space also involved into the discussions on how to deal with the materials that are left and the materials at station. So, at least most of them. But so at this point, I think we don't really have this problem of who's sort of controlling what and what's going online and who can give consent for it. But we'll definitely have at some point to think about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just certainly that question of like access versus like that tension between the well-being of the person whose oral history it is and their community, and the people who may live in isolated communities and not have access to those kind of stories, who could access them online. And so I think that this is the constant tension that we're all dealing with in the creation of these archives, and the impulse to
to do all this good work in the first place is this, like this in the
face of disaster,
right? Is to not lose these stories, knowing that these, you know, when, that it'll be hard to find these stories once these people are no longer with us. And so I think every individual project and every person needs to like have an approach. We have, I have a student right now who's doing oral histories, but it's explicitly about going online. Like the people who are being interviewed and telling their stories know that it's for the online audience. But even still, you can also do like graduated filtered access, those kinds of things, like have them available online and people can request access, those kind of things. You've probably thought about that.
Sure.
Yeah. We're doing a lot of stuff with that.
Yeah.
I saw another hand, front.
I'm wondering how all of you feel about archives you're collecting that are new archives, basically. Or do some of them have representation in other archives, more traditional archives? And is that a conflict? And then there's a thing that you raised about you did it as an art project. So then it's okay. I mean, that's how I operate. I feel like it's okay to introduce fictional elements, but I'm not dealing with living oral history. So, I mean, is it possible for an oral history to be archived in more than one place in a way that it gets to the public in different ways?
Sounds like there's almost two parts to that question in some ways, but don't you?
I may have something to say on this. When we started this work, I mean, at the very beginning, it was mostly mapping cruising parks and bringing the everyday events from these areas on a blog. But then, through time, it developed into something different. But we were avoiding any official archives, although there were art photos or some arty maps and things like that. They were never presented in big museums or libraries, the publication. It was not only that we were not even invited, but it was also that we felt that we don't want to do that. But then with time, somehow, it also became a field of interest. Because this exhibition, for example, this archive exists as an exhibition, and it was shown twice in a very small alternative spaces with very limited public, and it is also kind of a safe area where you really know that everyone will react positively to it. But then, this idea of archiving and conserving, let's say, some memory or something, is also, we wanted to have it somehow, something more permanent and more, I'm stupid to say real or whatever, but more officially archived. And so we do the publications with each exhibition. I mean, not with each exhibition if it's repeated, but each research project has a small publication, and actually there are still four of them or five there if someone wants to have one. It's only in Croatian, but has nice photos. And we decided when we published the first one, which is not this one, it was before this one, that we will also archive it as an official way how the publication in the countries are archived in the National Library with the numbers and everything. And so part of the material is present there, and it has become kind of conquesting the official archives and introducing some queer approach to memory and to history in that way. So this is this is probably answering the way that these archives are present in different places. So this is the more institutional way with the booklet that's done in a proper way how the archives official library wants it with all these numbers and registered with I don't know even how it's all called. And then the other material, it just floats somewhere under the bed and this paradise archives. And like also that this, this most of the photos from this project are in like the main gallery in town, like Contemporary Art Museum, but it's not like part of the official collection. It is like basically really parasitic, whatever the word is there. It's standing in an office of one of the curators, like unofficially there, but like we know it's there and I can take it when I need it, and they keep it there.
Janice, do you have anything to add to that question?
Well, specifically the question of oral history, we really don't do anything with oral history so far. And, you know, none of the things that we've worked on specifically are held in any other archives. They're really under the bed archives or lost archives that one tries to collect from a million different places. But, you know, you can think about models of, specifically, like indigenous repatriation models of claiming collections that have been stolen from their communities and taken over by museums, right? And so there's a lot of really cool digital projects being like, no, that's our collection. So even if they, as a community, don't have the money to buy it back from the Smithsonian in New York or from the Canadian Archives in Ontario, they have the digital strategies to be able to, anytime it gets, you know, clicked on, it tags back to them, and they can keep it in their orbit to send the message that tells them the traditional knowledge, that tells the user the traditional knowledge protocols of that item. Maybe the people's names that are named only as, you know, horrible colonial things that get labeled under those. So there are some really fascinating ways that people are using these kind of digital strategies against publicity and against exposure and really quite against access. To challenge the idea that we should have access to everything, and certainly Indigenous digital cultural heritage projects are doing that in the most interesting ways.
Do you all have anything else to add? We've got 1 minute left. Do any of us have any last minute thoughts before we let folks out?
I want to thank all of our panelists today. I really appreciate the fact that they're all working on such overtly political projects, and that they got paired together in this idea of connecting activists to archive in ways that are potentially very dangerous, right? Like holding on to some of this material is a real challenge in some way. So I want to thank you for the work that you're doing. And I want to thank all of you for coming today. Thank you so much. Feel free to hang out. Next up, we have dinner. So